We three kings be stealing the gold, intones Spike Jonze toward the beginning of today's film, as the character hilariously miscounts the number of U.S. Army soldiers involved in a scheme to steal booty from Saddam Hussein at the end of Operation Desert Storm. The star-studded cast includes George Clooney, Ice Cube, Marky Mark, Cliff Curtis, and Nora Dunn. After finding a map they believe depicts the location of millions of dollars in Kuwaiti bullion, one Special Forces officer and three ding-a-ling soldiers steal a Humvee and head into the desert to pull off what they believe will be the perfect crime. It's a heist film within a war film, and in the end, an attempt at a morality play about American interventionism and greed. The final scenes, after lots of combat hijinks and a particularly harrowing torture sequence, show the reformed and repentant main characters sacrificing their hoard of gold bricks to arrange for the safe border crossing of Shiite dissidents into Iran. The film has an edgy look, having been shot on reversal film and cross-processed to produce harsh contrast and vivid colors. It led a wave of big-budget studio films to adopt more experimental production techniques, and it put director David O. Russell on the map. But is today's movie a clean kill or a pocket full of bile? Find out as Friendly Fire takes on the 1999 film, Three Kings.
Welcome to Friendly Fire, the war movie podcast we were only supposed to do for 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks a year until this George Bush guy became president. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
And I'm John Roderick.
We're doing this in real life, guys.
This is the first time we've done this where we can see each other.
I've always wanted to meet you two.
You're a lot more handsome in person than I expected.
Oh, don't let that fool you. I'm quite abrasive and unpleasant to be
around.
Quite
dark inside.
Yeah. Most people say I'm exactly what they expected when they see me.
Just had a nice Podgonquin round table with one of your other co-conspirators, John.
That's right. America's sweetheart, Ken Jennings, just joined us for some barbecue, delicious barbecue.
Well, I'm beating around the bush because we have had a tough time getting together to record this one.
Well, together or even apart to record it. How long ago did we watch this movie with the expectation that we would be recording a podcast about it the following week?
Like 2 weeks ago, I woke up at 5 a.m. to watch this movie because I thought we were recording at like 7 a.m.
2 weeks ago?
Like the day that we were like officially going to record.
But
that was like the makeup record.
Yeah, when did we originally plan to record this episode?
More than a month ago.
I was going to say 6 weeks.
6 weeks, yeah. So 6 weeks I've been carrying around this stupid movie in my head. Just absolutely suffering from not being able to put it out of my mind. And here we are now, finally, I can finally put this movie to bed.
I mean, this feels like the right place to do it, here in the shadow of your Michigan highway side size American flag.
So we are, for the listeners should know, we are recording in my house, deep inside the darkest corner of my lair.
Ben is in one box at the foot of your bed, and I'm in the other.
Finally, two gimps after all these years. Adam's been here before. Ben, have you been to my house before?
I have. We shot some stuff for Engadget.com here many years ago.
That's right.
Out in your backyard. And you said, make sure when you shoot this, it is not clear where my house is.
Yeah, I think that ship has sailed.
And Gadget, for some reason, wanted a short video about candlesticks and globes.
Yeah, basically. This is the hot technology in those days, candlesticks and globes. So Three Kings is a movie about a war that was a joke at the time that it came out. And seems less like a joke now, I think.
Is this the first movie that we've talked about that where the war happened in recent memory?
Ooh.
Have we done a war yet where we were present and adults for the war?
Well, I was a kid for this one.
Oh, I suppose you were.
But I think you're right that this is a rare in living memory for us.
So far, at least, there are a lot more war movies of recent conflicts to cover.
Right, and conflicts that haven't even happened yet.
War movies to look forward to.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I remember when this movie came out, I saw it in the theater, and I remember it being really good at the time, and everybody agreed it was good. It was critically acclaimed. It was the movie that everyone was talking about.
Yeah.
It seemed like the tone was original and really like kind of it was a sort of an anti-war movie within a war adventure.
Like, finding the tone in a war movie, I feel like, has gone through so many iterations and so many eras now, and this is like an era where, like, the comment about war is the first thing that happens in the movie. A guy is like up on the top of a hut trying to surrender with a white flag, and they shoot him.
Right.
Like,
didn't think I'd get to see anybody shot in this war.
It's a really Wes Anderson looking death too. Like, it's totally symmetrically in frame and cutely colored.
Yeah.
In 1999, when this movie came out, like, this was independent film was at its most zeitgeisty.
Right.
And this was the first war movie that I could remember seeing, maybe remember seeing since, that looked like an independent film, that looked so artfully crafted,
like a lot of handheld camera. How else did it look so arty?
The color palette of the movie, yeah, is very extreme for the time, and I think I said this when we recorded last, but the VHS or DVD copy that I had of this when I was like a college kid had, like, in the pre-roll, this movie's color palette has been selected by the filmmaker to be very extreme. Do not attempt to adjust your set.
Like, really? How was? I mean, he just accomplished it by post-processing, or is that, he?
Yeah,
he was going for a look, and what would he have described that look as?
Instagram the war movie.
Yeah, they may have gone for like a cross-process kind of look, which is when you. I think that's when you use reversal film, but develop it like it's a negative. Is that right?
Is that what also accounts for all the grain? This is also, like, for a movie that you can get on Blu-ray, it was the most grainy,
yeah, it's
and
like
dirty-looking film that I've seen in quite a while.
Intentionally grainy.
Yeah.
Well, and so there was that element. Everything contributed to it feeling very almost journalistic, the handheld cameras, and the fact that it was giving you what seemed at the time to be an unvarnished look at, like, soldiers really sort of being gross and drunk and dumb. Like, actually portraying the rank and file soldier in Iraq as being kind of like a hick dummy, which felt pretty, I mean, since Apocalypse Now, the soldiers weren't very heroic, I guess.
Right, they are.
This is pre-9/11.
They're like, they're selfish and opportunistic.
Yeah,
primarily,
and like high, and also just like dumb.
Yeah,
and celebrating the end of a war they thought was over.
Right, and the war from the very beginning, not just in that that killing scene, but like everything made it seem like a joke war.
Yeah,
that was joke over. And there was that early scene where the kid was like, I didn't even get to shoot anybody.
Yeah.
And it just felt like, yeah, like a commentary on the army and on war that was really ironic and like I say, at the time felt very cool.
This book Jarhead that was made into a Jake Gyllenhaal movie that I think may be on our list of movies we will have to watch eventually. I think it came out during the second Gulf War, and in the book he spends like a lot of time talking about how nothing the war was, but how obsessed with war movies everybody that he went there with was. Like, he was just like a Marine deployed to Iraq, and like they just kind of like walked through Iraq without having ever engaged anybody, and like were greeted with bottles of water and celebration at the end. And the entire time, everybody is watching, like, Apocalypse Now and all these movies about Vietnam. They're like, fuck war. Like, the filmmakers are like, war is the fucking grimmest thing that destroys everybody that interacts with it. And they're like, yeah!
Yeah, we're playing World of Warcraft.
And I feel like Three Kings really, like knew that about the Iraq War without, like, explicitly saying it in a weird way.
What was hard for me was that in rewatching the movie, from the beginning, I intensely disliked it this time.
Really?
And I watched it with the expectation, even when it was on our list, of like, this is going to be amazing. Like, this was a fun, cool movie that was like, you know. And from the very beginning, I was just like, gross. This is really dated. And in the same way that you guys had that response to the movie MASH, where you were just like,
right,
I do not understand the cultural tone of this. I do not get where this movie's coming from. I was watching it, and I was just like, what the heck? This is like, these guys are going herp-a-derp.
You got mashed.
I got mashed because, you know, there were people dying. There were people like you could see communities being brutalized. And I didn't mind the treasure hunt narrative. I just thought the whole filmmaking approach of like the slapstick and the fact that there was just a lot of sort of like laugh lines or laugh shots where it was like, check it out, this guy just got a bullet through the center of his head, isn't that hilarious? And I just recoiled.
An unpopular opinion that I voiced recently was that I did not think The Departed was a good movie. And someone told me, and I don't know if it was you or not, Ben, but someone told me, but you know it's a comedy though, right?
The Departed.
Yeah. And that actually changed my whole thinking about that movie in a way that improved it.
Do I have to rewatch The Departed now and think of
it as a
comedy?
We're going to put The Departed on our list, on our war movie list, just for this reason. But was your reversal of feeling about the film, did that have anything to do with how seriously you thought this film would take the war? And because it did not, was that your reason for disliking it? Put another way, if you thought this movie was a comedy, do you think you would like it more because of how unseriously it treated the subject?
I knew it was a comedy from the moment it came on, right? Yeah. Because all the signaling is about it being a comedy. And I'm not somebody that post 9/11 was very support our troops. I mean, I wasn't offended that way. And I really liked George Clooney in Syriana.
Right.
Although that was him in his maybe best dramatic role.
Right.
I don't generally think that, I think Clooney mugs his way through everything he does.
There's definitely like
he ate his way through Syriana though.
Yeah, he did.
I feel like Clooney puts on a very conspicuous tiny hat when he is doing comedy, and
yeah,
it's, you cannot ignore it.
It's just in his eyes, it's in his face, and then you know, Marky Mark can do two things, and he does them both in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, he does those things. It's so much fun, though.
I loved Spike Jonze. And I've actually met Spike Jonze and found him to be exactly as you would expect. He, like, Wes Anderson'd me at the Chateau Marmont one time.
Cool.
It was pretty cool, yeah. He actually, he referred to me and Dick Cavett as the two unfunny ones in the group. He was like, and you two, the two unfunny ones. And I was like, fuck you, man. But then I realized the other guy was Dick Cavett. So I was like, yeah, all right, I'll take it. But he was hilarious in the movie, playing what you would consider, what you would call an incredibly broad portrayal of a hick ding-a-ling.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed him because he felt like, in a way, the realest of all those characters.
The entire story is portrayed as like a victimless crime caper until he becomes injured and until he becomes a part of the culture, until he depends on the culture to save his life.
Right.
Like, that's our point of engagement into Iraqi culture. Up until then, it is just like throwing the football around and crushing beers.
Yeah.
I feel like that may be the tonal problem with the film, is that we don't, like, it takes a few beats to talk to us about like the horrors that have been visited on the civilian population, both by the invading American army and by the dictator that they live under the boot heel of, but you never actually like have real personal experiences with any of them. It's like they have to exposition it at at the American soldiers for it to be on screen.
Yeah, right. That's the dramatic moments in this in the film are all pure exposition. You have no idea what you have done to my people, and then a long list of like all the walking you through the war crimes. And you're just like, oh, okay. I mean, I guess I could just have read this on a poster.
Right.
The scene where he gets shot and all of a sudden we're transported inside his abdomen and we see the bullet move through his fleshy parts to give us a sense of like how he's been injured. Like, it was very creative. And at the time, I had a super literally visceral reaction to this viscera.
Yeah, the bile part.
But now it felt like something that even Wes Anderson wouldn't like stoop to. It was so cartoony.
Paul Thomas Anderson did that in Magnolia in almost an identical manner. And that's what made me think of
another movie that I tiptoed around in feeling like, was this good? Or no.
Magnolia, also a war movie you can look out for in a later episode.
Adam is arguing all the time for loosening up the definition of what this podcast is about.
A war movie of Tom Cruise against his dad.
Yeah.
I want to make... you've made your case for Three Kings being a shitty movie.
I know you guys liked it, but you liked Goonies, too.
Dismissive of the people that were victimized by this war, but... I do want to give Three Kings a special citation in having the greatest call to adventure of maybe any movie anywhere, which is pulling a piece of rolled up paper out of a butt. That still makes me laugh.
In the same way that you had a visceral reaction to the bullet entering the body, the very specific Foley sound of what paper sounds like being pulled from an asshole.
They must have worked so hard on that.
Yeah.
I wish I could communicate how ninth grade your faces are right now. It's just like... It's unbelievable.
How long do you think the meeting was where they discussed how much brown to have on the end of that rolled up piece of paper?
I feel like that was a director's decision.
They should keep that rolled up map in the Smithsonian.
I think about so much of just all around that ass document. The fact that they call it an ass document. The fact that there's then like a cut to a scene where they're inside a tent with it. And you have to think about like, how did they get the ass document to the tent? They like put it in a baggie and somebody put the baggie in their pocket. And then they had a poopy piece of paper in their pocket.
Are you like drunk on steak or what is happening to you? You really are loving this poop document.
I love the poop document. I am a little bit drunk on barbecue. We just came from a pretty kingly meal. I also wanted to talk about the media in this, because it's like more a contemporary war thing, like the way the media interacts with the soldiers, and this movie has a lot of fun with that relationship. I mean, I feel like our main media correspondent, Adriana Cruz, who's kind of like the secondary antagonist of the film, is fucking great and really hilariously portrayed.
By Nora Dunn, right?
Yeah, and as big an asshole as any of the soldiers, like just as much there to like to. I mean, like, and I think this is a thing about war that like people don't just go to war for king and country; they go for like self betterment and sometimes even self enrichment, which is what this is about. And she's like there to make her career, and she's got a fucking axe to grind about it because she's like
her tour guide, as played by Jamie Kennedy,
is fucking...
maybe no better person to articulate the United States military mission for being in Iraq than Jamie Kennedy. Like, and that's his only job for the whole movie.
her whole C storyline is just hilarious to me. The fact that they like take her on a wild goose chase and then she's the only one that has like an emotional breakdown when she sees like birds crawling around in crude oil on the ground.
The structure of this movie, seeing it, I think, for the first time in maybe 10 years, was really surprising to me because I thought this was a caper movie for its entire 2 hours. but it really was half caper movie and the first half really fucking around. We really don't, like, the stakes are not raised for quite a while. Like, there are no stakes at all. The victimless crime idea being portrayed throughout, like, it takes a guy getting shot. It takes that person being executed in that first town for the scales to be lifted from their eyes and for them to actually see the war for what it is. And that was a part that I reflexively flinched at, too, which is, like, if you're portraying soldiers in a foreign conflict with this laissez-faire attitude about where they are in the combat, and they're acting like this is the first time they've seen someone killed, like, I sort of disconnected with their cause at that point. I did not feel sorry for them, even though that was the moment when we were told as viewers we had to ride for these three characters.
Well, there are a lot of people that die in the movie, and everyone that dies at the hands of an American gun is just a faceless soldier, right? Like, American guns are shooting, and it's always sort of people at a distance who are dying Hollywood style, like, ah, you got me, and then they fall off the top of a...
Squeezing off 15 rounds in the air from there.
And then they fall from the top of a castle, and you don't see the body land in the ground because it landed on a mattress. All of the people that get shot where it's a tragedy, where we're meant to feel like pain, they're all shot actually by other Iraqis. So the whole conflict is portrayed a little bit like, I mean, the American army gets off a little bit scot-free, right? They're portrayed as goofuses.
Yeah.
Who are like, whoa! But they're sort of just shooting baddies with impunity. But the real bad guy in this movie is Saddam Hussein, whom we never see, and all of the brainwashed Republican Guard are the ones that commit the real atrocities.
The torture scene is really interesting to me because it's like the interrogator.
My man.
Played by Saeed Tagmaoui, apologies if I'm brutalizing the pronunciation of his name, is like portrayed simultaneously as like not wrong and like obscenely brutal at the same time. Like the axe he has to grind with the American army is like he's making fair points about the fact that they like don't really know why they're there or what they're doing. They like they represent a culture that is to a certain extent lost, and they're in a kind of a war of adventure more than like fighting for a real cause. Meanwhile, his wife and baby are being bombed. But then he's like also torturing him, and like it's not really clear like what the interrogation is for. Like, what information is this guy theoretically torturing this American soldier to get? Like, is he just there to like make a really powerful point by dumping oil down his throat on a Michael Jackson CD? It's like a scene that's like really intense, but also when you do the math later, it's like, what the hell was that about?
It seems totally concept-y.
Yeah.
And not plotty.
Right. Like, what would be the lasting image from this film? Like, what is this film as a movie poster? And that's it.
Yeah.
And I think we live in a post-popularization of torture universe. And at the time, 1999, you hadn't seen that many contemporaneous depictions of that kind of torture. Tie a guy to a chair, electrocute his genitals, and waterboard him, basically. And so that, again, was another example, like the bullet in the lung, that felt like, whoa, this is really hard-hitting, gritty filmmaking at the time.
I mean, at the same time, like, that, like, the interrogator, like, convinces Marky Mark's character of his points.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Because he goes, like, Marky Mark, at, like, in the all of the shit leading up to that is, like, fuck these people, we're here to steal gold and get out, like, this is for me and mine, who cares about what happens to them, like, not our problem. And then he like, has an opportunity to shoot the guy that's been, you know, shocking his nipples and dumping oil down his throat, and he shoots the wall, and then it's, like, 100% a mission to save the people that got him out of jail and get them over the border.
Yeah,
him.
He's meant to be the proxy for us, the uninformed American citizen who was rah-rah about the war and now has had our eyes opened by this gritty scene that the Iraqis are real people.
Yeah, he's the white savior all of a sudden.
But
what it does is it totally amplifies Mark Wahlberg into that high-pitched, frantic Mark Wahlberg, which is personally my favorite version.
Of the two?
Yeah.
I just felt like...
basically post-coke Mark Wahlberg from Boogie Nights, like for the rest of Three Kings. That's what he is.
Watching it in the context of having spent...
Boogie Nights also being added to the war films, by the way.
Are we putting Boogie Nights in?
I'm going to keep trying if you guys keep trying. Let's keep rocking and rolling, man.
Right. I'm going to stop interrupting you now.
No. In that case, I want to have all of Marky Mark's films because he's really at war with the camera in everything he does. I'm just saying that, like, since Abu Ghraib.
I believe George Bush pronounced it Abu Ghraib.
Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib. Since then, and certainly since Zero Dark Thirty, it's no longer weird. Or it's no longer like shocking. I mean, it's still shocking, but we've seen much more shocking depictions of that style of torture. And so watching it in this movie, it felt cartoony again. The weird edition of the Michael Jackson CD, that whole thing was just like, why is it like this in this movie? But then I'm the sourpuss about it, and I don't wanna rain on Adam's like
I only
super.
Medium liked it, I promise.
and Ben seems to feel like it's like a sequel to Airplane.
Do you guys want to hear a quibble from the internet fact-checking brigade?
Always.
When Sergeant Barlow, that's Marky Mark's character, when Sergeant Barlow calls the U.S., the ringback sound he hears sounds like a British phone would. But the ring, when calling international, is that of the country you are calling to. Therefore, Barlow would have heard a familiar American ring.
Rop, rop, rop.
Ba-da-ring. I found that scene really affecting.
Where he called his wife.
Yeah.
That was pretty heavy.
Yeah.
He found a cell phone in a pile of cell phones and got through.
Her performance was striking and heavy.
It was one of the better like performances in the movie, very brief, but she really accomplished that mission.
Yeah, where's she? Like, she was so great. I feel like somebody should have been like, okay, let's put her in something. Yeah.
And the fantasy scene of cutting to his house and his family and getting blown up was even more affecting because you got to know her in that little scene before.
Yeah. She's great. She's also like, she's not the, like, I mean, she's a very beautiful woman, but not in the like way that all women in the picture of the like girl back home are like uniformly beautiful in the exact same way in most of these movies. She's not put on a pedestal. She's just his wife, you know,
and plays that really well.
Yeah.
And the others, I mean, there were several scenes in the movie that were, I thought, really successful dramatically and like emotionally affecting. And when the mom got killed, and then every scene subsequent to that where the little girl was, I thought that little girl was a good actor too, and really conveyed that kind of like, sure, my mom was just shot and now I am really, really freaked out about everything that's happening. Yeah. That struck me each time.
That moment of the mom being killed failed to invest me in what I think the movie was trying to invest me in, but instead invested me in something else, which was like, I felt like the movie wanted me to think that our three kings were involved because they felt grief over this injustice. But at the time, it almost read as frustration, as in, like, if you're an off-duty police officer and you see someone shoplifting, like, oh, God, I've got to get involved in this because I'm wearing a uniform. That kind of resignation to their interest in becoming involved was a major barrier to me really caring about them as people and whether or not they were going to like marshal the group to safety. Like, it was their perspective, their intention behind that sort of ruined it for me.
Yeah, I guess that's a script thing too, because it's definitely, I mean, it's definitely the argument that they have. I guess, like, to defend it a little bit, maybe this is the larger point that the movie is trying to make, is like, it took so much horribleness for them to stop thinking about themselves.
Right.
Like, when it cuts to them like having their horrible lives, like, oh, Ice Cube had a suitcase open up on him while he was trying to put it on a conveyor belt. Poor him. He should steal $20 million worth of gold to make his life better. Like the people that they're running roughshod over are in so much worse shape. And it like really takes a lot for them to be shaken out of that. And I mean, like, to be charitable, I guess, now that we all hate this movie, at least the movie is saying like Americans are maybe dispositionally unfairly ignorant of the way people have it in the parts of the world that we're always invading.
I think that was the script thing that rankled me the most, which is, in the end, it lets America off the hook because these three guys, our proxies, or these four guys, our proxies,
they're redeemed.
They're redeemed because they suddenly get feelings at a certain point. And I remember thinking that this was a breakout role for Ice Cube, who I always loved. I loved him as a performer. I loved him as an actor.
He's very good in this movie.
Right.
He's very good, but he is playing Ice Cube. Like, he's just doing the thing that he does, which is play outraged and frustrated Ice Cube. But as you described, like, getting back into his backstory in this movie, he's got zilch to be Ice Cube about, right? It doesn't like it doesn't take him back to Compton where he's like fighting with the cops. He's a baggage handler at the Detroit airport, and he's not good at his job, so he joins the army. And so he's Ice Cubing it up the whole time. And so what's he so Ice Cube about?
I love how everyone gets their moment to offer their personal biographical information to help solve a problem, like his deal with the tensile strength of the bags to hold the gold bars. That was a laugh out loud line for me.
That was pretty funny. There were funny.
He works in an airport.
That gold bar scene leads me to another question, which is, like, part of their plan in saving all of these people is giving everyone a gold bar and ushering them over the border like it's going to remake some lives. But this, to me, like, this is like the $100 bill problem. In some towns, a $100 bill is unspendable. What are these people going to do with these gold bars once they get over the border?
Yeah. I mean, imagine you're a 60-year-old Iraqi woman who's now pushed over the border into Iran.
Where you don't speak the language.
With a 100-ounce bar of gold.
Yeah.
How long are you going to have that gold in your hand before somebody pushes you down and takes it?
Right.
Like, this is not a solution at all. And every one of them takes that gold bar like, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm moving to New York and getting a 2-bedroom apartment. And it's like, I'm sorry, but the border guards on the Iranian side, as soon as they're through the fence, are going to just take all that gold instantly. But that was what I think the most confusing thing about the film. And I mean, I was already against it, but when I got to the end and realized that it was not a caper movie, but it was a moralizing, like, supposed to be like feel good redemption story where these four dummies came to Jesus and, you know, relinquished all their money and fought the upper brass, who at the last minute were telling them they couldn't save these refugees because they just had to turn them back.
Yeah.
And then it was like, I'm going to turn myself over, you know, unless we save these. It was just all of every bit of that sanctimony was not in keeping with it as a comedy.
Right.
If it's going to be a comedy caper at the end, like have them be greedy again or have something happen that isn't just descending into a kind of Jimmy Stewart, like, oh, well, you know, I sold my house to pay for the little boy's mechanical leg.
Well, and they're deftly using the media as cover, like, oh, because the cameras are rolling,
which felt really au courant in 99.
I mean, I feel like Robert Altman would never tie it up like this. It's interesting to like rewrite the movie in my mind, like, what would the end be if the like selfish, self-destructive and ignorant position they took at the beginning actually had consequences.
Mm-hmm. Right, where all those people died and they took that money home.
A modern war film would have killed one of its main characters, and I thought that all of them survived. Actually, no shit. One of them did die, didn't he?
Yeah, Spike Jones died.
Spike Jones died.
Oh, right.
You know what? That might speak to another thing that I felt. I didn't care when he died. And I should care about a main character dying.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was the one sympathetic character.
Right.
He died, and we did...
He was so clearly established as fourth place, though.
Right, the red shirt guy.
Yeah.
Even though he was, the clearest portrayal of an actual person by this Southern California skate kid who had to learn how to speak like a West Virginia poor kid.
He was the heart of the film in that he was the one who first showed empathy for the Iraqis. He was the one who was in love with Mark Wahlberg in a, you know, male friendship. Like, he was the one willing to be emotional at every point in a way that no one else was.
His ignorance and kind of like knee-jerk Christianity and knee-jerk sort of like American exceptionalism was also the first thing to crumble in the face of actual evidence.
Yeah.
So he was like, oh, y'all got religion here too? What's it all about? It's like, you know, he was the open-minded one,
right?
By virtue of not...
What kind of shrine y'all got?
I don't really have a day job, sir.
So, and then at the end, you know, they try to get a comedy note out of it by doing the Animal House, where are they now?
Yeah.
And just...
And he's totally forgotten in that, which I feel like is maybe disingenuous as well. Like, if they'd like said something about like what his family went through or whatever, like,
but no, it was too late for anything real at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. My understanding was that George Clooney and the director hated one another during the filming of this.
Really?
And fought the entire time, fought like violently on the set, punching each other.
There was an argument between an actor and David O. Russell.
And I'm saying this was maybe the first one, and that Clooney and O. Russell actually went public in the media at the time saying, I'll never work with that guy again.
Wow.
I think he's not only a bad... Clooney was saying, not only a bad director, but abusive to other people. And I had to step in and like physically restrain him because working for him is like should be... he is a crime. He's he's a criminal. And eventually I think they resolved it, but O. Russell said that Clooney was trying to get control over the script and over the shots, and because this was supposed to be Clooney's star maker. He was coming off of ER, and he wanted to...
Right.
This was the vehicle he was going to ride to movie fame, and I think he did. I think Marky Mark and Clooney and Ice Cube all came out the other side of this movie thought of as actors, where prior they were kind of
big timers.
Yeah.
Was this before or after Clooney Batman?
That is a question I could never answer. Did David O. Russell direct him in Batman? No.
I lobotomized all the Schumacher Batman memories.
Yeah, it's Joel Schumacher directing.
Yeah,
that.
Okay, good. Never leave the cave without it. I think it had to be before, right? Because, I mean, if my story holds.
1997 for Batman and Robin. But that doesn't... I mean, that put a real stink on George Clooney for a while, because it's such a fucking atrociously bad movie. Yeah, that was 2 years before Three Kings. Like, it is such an interesting era. It's like right in that last little bit before we had like new shit to be a scared of as a
right
as a body politic and as a zeitgeist. So it's not really scared of anything.
Well, this is... you think about, the war was immediately pre Bill Clinton, and this movie is very, very tail end of the Clinton administration. So the Clinton years were a time when everything in America just felt like, whoa, it was just, you know, very Arsenio Hall era of what the stakes were, because we hadn't really... I mean, Black Hawk Down, I guess, was the sort of the worst moment, or the genocide in
Rwanda.
In Rwanda were the two, and I guess also, of course, the war in Kosovo, or I'm sorry, in the Serbo-Croatian war.
Yeah, and all three of those, I think, are things that were even more distant and secondary in our minds than, you know, than even the first Gulf War.
Right. It was never clear what we should have done in Rwanda. Most people, including me, don't even remember what the Bosnian War was called.
Yeah.
Black Hawk Down was a good movie.
On the list.
I will probably be arguing against Black Hawk Down being a good movie when we sit down to review that.
This is going to be fun.
I mean, like, this movie also has the scene of, like, what did we do here? What was this even about? Which I feel like about half the movies we've had at this point on our show have had that scene. But this movie, it seemed like, I guess we have to have this scene.
Right.
You know?
I mean, it was surprisingly, and maybe this is another reason why it felt fresh at the time, it was surprisingly without a lot of the war movie tropes.
Right.
That we've seen in movie after movie after movie.
It's like war is a place. Let's do a caper there, and then we can like exploit the placeness of it to do something bigger with a caper than we normally would be able to.
Yeah. There was the clueless CO who just wanted to do it by the book and wanted to bust Clooney down.
Yeah.
And who spent the movie trying to figure out where they were so he could get there and bust it.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was no... Where was the Rickles? There was no Rickles. It was all Rickles all the time.
It was Rickles all the way down?
All the great Rickles.
Well, I don't know. I hated to be such a downer coming into this thing, and part of it is that I've been sitting for 6 weeks just letting this movie fester like somebody cracked an egg into the top of my toilet tank.
You're no longer movie constipated.
but yeah, I gave
what
this...
would happen if you cracked an egg in the top of a toilet tank? It would just come out in the bowl when you flushed, right? And then you'd have like scrambled egg bowl.
Let's see. I guess
we could do some experimentation after we're done recording.
Yeah, why don't we try that at Adam's house? You can report to me what happened.
By the way, I went to the bathroom right before we recorded, and I went in there, and the stink bug that Ken Jennings had picked up off your Braille Playboys in the front room was swimming around.
He was alive.
He was alive. It was a unspeakable act of cruelty that proceeded from there.
Well, yeah, I mean, he went down to his final resting place in Davy Jones' locker, right?
Yeah.
Stinkbug Jones' locker. But anyway, we have yet to give movies like any kind of thumbs up, thumbs down, and I really hate to be so sour about it, but
I feel like a rating system may be something we want to consider for this show. I mean, we're like whatever, more than a dozen episodes in at this point. Do we need to institute some kind of...
I think the rating system should be customized to every film. And for this film, it's on a scale of 1 to 5 Nerf footballs strapped with explosives.
I like it. John, how many Nerf footballs strapped with explosives do you give 1999's Three Kings?
Well, let me ask for a clarification. Is... zero Nerf footballs allowable, and is that the lowest rating, or is 5 Nerf footballs strapped with explosives?
I think we can all agree that Nerf footballs strapped with explosives are great.
Yeah, they are.
So
that's true.
5 would be an ideal number.
I'm going to give this 2 Nerf footballs strapped with explosives and 1 Nerf baseball with an M80 tape.
You were a real terror in high school, I can tell.
How many baseballs are there in a football?
There are more than 2 baseballs in a football. I would say a football is comprised of 4 baseballs.
I'm sure that if you go to the Spalding factory or whatever, that's how they're doing it.
One of the things we can do later is try and see how many baseballs we can fit into a football.
let's split up. I'll be on team toilet. Adam, how many would you give of Nerf footballs strapped with explosives?
I was thinking about how many more Nerf footballs strapped with explosives I would have given this film, having just seen it in college, than I do now. I really loved this film when I first saw it, and it made me feel like I was able to have a high-minded, articulate conversation about the Iraq War, yeah, which was something before seeing this movie I felt incapable of. At the time this film came out, this really felt like a comment on it that felt smart and interesting and new. And I don't know whether it is the idea that the war still goes on and it's so not funny, or just how I have changed as a person and a film watcher, but I probably would have given it between 4 and 5 football strapped with explosives in college, and now I would only give it 3. 3 mostly because of how great Mark Wahlberg is.
Yeah. Ben, how many Nerf footballs strapped with explosives do you give the film?
I will give it 3 Nerf footballs and 2 baseballs with M80s. For the many of the reasons that you guys have said, but also like those 2 baseballs are exclusively ass document.
I see.
Bonuses.
That scene gets 2
baseballs strapped with M80s.
This movie is very sceney. It's a run of fun, interesting scenes. Map ass is one such scene for Ben. Do you have a scene that maybe is a scene that sticks out to you as your favorite in that same way?
Well, sure. When they discover Saddam's supposed collection of vintage cars and commandeer
them. That's a fun scene.
And when you really think about, like, Saddam's collection of vintage cars would be presumably in Baghdad, and it would be a bunch of, like, phenomenal sports cars. And this is really some Republican Guard colonel's collection of vintage cars. There's like a white stretch limo and a Jaguar, and hilariously this Mitsubishi Eclipse convertible.
Yeah,
I love how dorky the like imported cultural things are. Like, I mean, this may just be like cultural chauvinism or whatever, but like everything that they like want really badly is like stacks of jeans and like a fucking blender that he says newest and best.
Yeah, cell phones, like a stack of cell phones.
Yeah.
Well, and that's some of the, what would you call it, Orientalism or cultural imperialism that isn't part of our culture now. And it's not to say that we understand really Iraqis any better, but this was a time when you could still have a lot of Iraqi extras or a lot of extras playing Iraqis who are just there for comedic effect. The scene, however, where they all come rolling out in this convoy of like mismatched Des Moines, Iowa car museum. Des Moines probably has great car museums. This just felt like the car museum of a guy that owns a service station. I just loved the idea of a commandeered flotilla of garbage cars. And then the excitement that Wahlberg and Ice Cube showed about this Mitsubishi Eclipse convertible, where they really, for a brief moment, you could see who they were back home. Like, yeah. Dude, is that the, oh my God, it's the Eclipse. I knew that you could get that with extra, you know, like extra chewing gum or whatever. And it was it was one of these vignettes where you go, yeah, I just want to hear, I'd actually watch a movie of these guys getting excited about like the cool car of 1999. And we didn't have to have this whole scene or this whole movie where people were getting shot.
That was legit fun and funny in a way that really worked, that so many other times it kind of didn't.
Yeah.
My favorite scene happened right after that, which was the anachronism of If You Leave Me Now, like cruising through the desert to that song specifically.
Yeah.
Like, after having just survived something awful, the, like, peace of that moment, I loved that scene.
The yacht rock really is effective there, isn't it?
Yeah, it really
take
is.
Take away the biggest part of...
And everyone's just looking out the window, and Wahlberg's in the back, like, draining his lung. Yeah. Like, I love that moment.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah. Did you guys have guys... John is like, oh, fuck. That's a segment still. Damn it.
Yeah, my guy was the angry Republican Guard torturer. I thought he did a good job portraying that amount of emotion in a film that otherwise had no real emotional performances.
Yeah,
everyone else was kind of just coasting or bumbling their way, and this guy somehow in the middle of that found a way to communicate that his wife and child had been murdered in by an American bomb senselessly, and actually got to me. And he's an actor that you see.
Yeah, he's a real that guy.
Yeah, he appears in other things.
I'm glad he's still working, because I think he's really terrific.
Yeah, but he wasn't fake mad.
Yeah, I feel like the way he interacts with Marky Mark is not only well performed, but it's also very well written. Like, he's laying little rhetorical traps for Mark Wahlberg the whole time, and Mark Wahlberg like reliably steps in them.
And honestly, this is that scene was one of Mark Wahlberg's moments as an actor, I think, where he wasn't any more able to just sit and flex and be the tough guy, but he was right. Like confused and bewildered and scared, and it was effective. Who's your guy, Adam? The guy with the map in his butt?
The guy who was driving the milk truck semi is my guy. What is he doing there? Where did he get all that milk?
When I saw
and
them,
where did he go after the truck flipped over?
Yeah, right. How did he get home?
Yeah.
Well, he, in a body bag, he filled up with holes.
Yeah, yeah. He went out real ugly.
The milk truck driver.
Yeah. They all get washed out by that milk, and I was thinking about how bad they must smell for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
My guy is Adriana Cruz's cameraman, who doesn't, I don't think he has, he maybe has like three lines in the movie, but he does a lot of real fun background acting.
She abuses him, yeah.
Yeah, and like, you know, they put Bolo, Jamie Kennedy's character, on the task of taking her very far off course of being near them while they're stealing the gold, and the camera guy is just in the background like, this is fucking hilarious, and I don't care, like, I get paid the same either way. Like, doesn't make any difference to me. And I feel like I've been on a job or two like that, you know?
Yeah, including this podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
That's kind of your role here.
Mm-hmm. He's just laughing at that ass map.
You only gave me one glove.
Well, guys, should we select our next motion picture on the topic of war?
It might even be a movie we've mentioned on this episode.
We have mentioned a lot of movies.
Fingers crossed for Magnolia.
All right, guys, we have 54 movies here on our list. John, do you want to select a random number? Not including 29, which doesn't appear to have anything on it.
A random number between 1 and 54.
Yeah.
You know, usually, do I ever skew up? I usually skew down, right? I pick 13 a lot.
You pick 13 a lot.
Let's say 48.
48. 48 is 1978's Force 10 from Navarone.
Ooh,
oh, directed boy. By Guy Hamilton.
Force 10 from Navarone.
This is a movie you put on the list, John.
I have seen Force 10 from Navarone probably 50 times.
So you don't even need to rewatch it.
Oh,
should we just like roll right into it?
You can tell us about it. Through every note, every scene of that film. And it's like, and it's sub Bridge Over the River Kwai plot. But yeah, okay, I'm excited about it.
So many movie titles of this genre are similar to me. Like, I don't know that I could distinguish Force 10 from Navarone, from Guns of the Navarone, from, it's sort of like the Deerhoof, Deer Hunter, Deer Tick band name situation.
Yeah,
like,
right. Who are those bands?
Yeah.
Which one is cool and which one, well, I mean, I think they're all cool,
is
right?
Is this the cool Navarone movie?
Deer Hunter, Deer Tick, and Deer, what was the other one? Deer Fuzz?
Deerhoof.
Deerhoof. Yeah, they're all cool bands.
Right.
I've seen The Guns of Navarone, and that's a cool movie.
So Guns of Navarone was a classic black and white film And
it's like the movie where they put together the crack squad with the explosives guy and the guy with the knives.
I'm positive that's what I'm thinking of, but that's not what this movie is.
Well,
right?
and there's always, you know, there's always a surprise betrayer, and then they, you know, and then there's a suspenseful moment at the end where it's like, did the plan work? Are we going to defeat the Germans, or did it all? So then in the 1970s,
I love it when that part happened. It was great.
In the 1970s, they made Force 10 from Navarone, which has no, there, it's like a sequel, but contains none of the same actors. It's not in any way, you know, but it's basically a new film set in a different place with exactly the same plot, exactly the same. Each person is basically analogous to a prior character, and they do the same movie, but just at a different time in a different place.
Like Airport and Airport 79.
Yeah. And it has Harrison Ford in it.
Whoa.
In an early role. I'm not sure whether it's immediately post Star Wars or immediate. I guess it's immediately post Star Wars, his first movie after Star
Man,
Wars.
Man, I'm.
That's fun.
Tumescent thinking about it.
And a lot of exciting other guest characters, including Jaws from Moonraker.
Cool.
And a lot of other actors you will recognize.
I'm really excited to see this movie, and I'm almost positive I'm going to watch the wrong movie. Someone please remind me.
So they're Force 10,
yeah.
Right? Like, which means that they, I guess, and oh, and also Force 10 from Navarone has nothing to do with Navarone. Navarone does not appear in it at all.
Navarone's just a fictional place too, right?
Navarone was based on the original movie was based on an actual caper, an actual event.
Yeah.
It wasn't exact, it was fictionalized.
It's Navarone as a feeling.
That's right. These guys were like it feels like the sons of Navarone.
The producer just owned the word Navarone and was like, I know how we'll get some asses in some seats.
But it's a great example of a late 70s World War II movie as opposed to a 50s World War II movie, because there was that like spate of World War II movies in the 70s, like Midway and this Tora Tora or whatever, these movies that were, let's go back to World War II. It was fun to make movies then.
Let's refight it.
Patton and whatnot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This Vietnam is such a bummer.
Directors are always fighting the last war.
Well, the one before that.
Yeah. Well, this has been Friendly Fire, and that will be the movie we watch next time. And so for John Roderick and Adam Pranica, I've been Ben Harrison. To Victor, go the spoiler alerts.
Hey everyone, Rob Schulte here, the producer of Friendly Fire. I just wanted to break the fourth wall real quick to say thank you so much for all the support you've been giving this show. It's incredible. I love the community involved in working on this Maximum Fun show. It's my first year, so being able to see you all support Friendly Fire via downloads and iTunes reviews and all the positive feedback on the social media is one thing, but also being able to see that people actually donate to the show is incredible. So if you haven't yet, consider it. Head on over to MaximumFun.org/donate and check off Friendly Fire is one of the shows that that you're a fan of. All right, you do that and I'll continue to make good pods.
Absolutely. Listen to me.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist owned.
Listener supported.